This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, by Doris Kearns Goodwin, narrated by Suzanne Torin, and directed by T.G. Reynolds and Tiana Kennedy.
Ulysses S. Grant, the hero of Vicksburg and Chattanooga, arrived in the nation's capital on March 8, 1864, to take command of all the Union armies. A grateful Congress had revived the grade of lieutenant general, not held since George Washington, and Lincoln had nominated Grant to receive the honored rank. With Grant's promotion, Halleck became chief of staff, and Sherman assumed Grant's old command of the Western armies. Grant's entrance into Washington was consistent with his image as an unpretentious man of action, the polar opposite of McClellan. He walked into the Willard Hotel at dusk, accompanied only by his teenage son, Fred. Unrecognized by the desk clerk, he was told that nothing was available except a small room on the top floor. The situation was remedied only when the embarrassed clerk looked at the signature in the register, U.S. Grant and Son, Galena, Illinois, and immediately switched the accommodations. After freshening up, Grant took his son to the dining room at the lobby level. His slim build, stooping shoulders, mild blue eyes, and light brown hair and whiskers attracted little notice until someone began pointing at his table. Suddenly, there was a shout of welcome from all present, an immense cheer going up from the crowd, who banged their fists on the tops of the tables until he finally stood up and took a bow. After readying his son for bed, Grant walked over to the White House, where a large crowd had gathered for the president's weekly reception. Horace Porter, a young colonel who would later become Grant's aide-de-camp, was standing near Lincoln in the Blue Room when a sudden commotion near the entrance to the room attracted general attention. The cause was the appearance of General Grant, walking along modestly with the rest of the crowd toward Mr. Lincoln. Meeting Grant for the first time, Lincoln's face lit up with a broad smile. Not waiting for his visitor to reach him, the president advanced rapidly two or three steps, taking Grant by the hand. "Why, here is General Grant. Well, this is a great pleasure." Porter was struck by the physical contrast between the two men. From his uncommon height, the president looked down with beaming countenance upon Grant, who stood 8 inches shorter. The collar on Lincoln's evening dress was a size too large, his necktie awkwardly tied. He seemed to Porter more of a Hercules than an Adonis, yet Porter noted the merry twinkle in his gray eyes, and a tone of familiarity that instantly set people at ease. Watching the two men together, Wells, who was also present, was slightly disconcerted by Grant's demeanor, remarking on his lack of soldierly presence, a degree of awkwardness. After talking with Grant, Lincoln referred him to Seward, knowing that his gregarious secretary could best help the general navigate the crowds of admirers shouting his name and rapidly descending upon him. So frantic was the cheering throng to draw near the conquering hero that laces were torn, crinoline mashed, and things were generally much mixed. Seward rapidly maneuvered Grant into the East Room, where he persuaded the general to stand on a sofa so that everyone could see his face. "He blushed like a girl," the New York Herald correspondent noted. The handshaking brought streams of perspiration down his forehead and over his face. Grant later remarked that the reception was his warmest campaign during the war. The president was delighted by the crowd's embrace of Grant. He willingly ceded to the unassuming general his own customary place of honor, fully aware that the path to victory was wide enough, as Porter phrased it, for the two of them to walk it abreast. Lincoln's reception of Grant might have been more calculated if he had thought the general intended to compete for the presidency. But he had ascertained from a trustworthy source that Grant wanted nothing more than to successfully complete his mission to end the war. "My son, you will never know how gratifying that is to me," Lincoln had told J. Russell Jones, the emissary who carried a letter from Grant, affirming that not only did he have no desire for the presidency, but he fully supported keeping Mr. Lincoln in the presidential chair. After mingling with the excited crowd for an hour, the indefatigable Seward and the exhausted general made their way back to Lincoln, who was waiting with Stanton in the drawing-room. They talked over the details of the ceremony the next day, when Grant would be given his commission. To help him prepare his response, Lincoln handed the general a copy of the remarks he would deliver before Grant was expected to speak. Returning to his room at the Willard, Grant wrote out his statement in pencil on a half-sheet of paper. When the time came the following afternoon to speak, he seemed, according to Nicolay, quite embarrassed by the occasion, and, finding his own writing so very difficult to read, he stumbled through his speech. After the ceremony, Lincoln and Grant went upstairs to talk in private. Lincoln explained that while procrastination on the part of commanders had led him in the past to issue military orders from the White House, all he wanted, or had ever wanted, was someone who would take the responsibility and act, leaving to him the task of mobilizing all the power of the government to provide whatever assistance was needed. On Thursday, Grant journeyed by rail to the headquarters of the Army of the Potomac to consult with General Meade. Upon Grant's return, Lincoln informed him that Mrs. Lincoln was planning a dinner in his honor that Saturday. When Grant begged off, arguing that he wanted to get back to the field as soon as possible, Lincoln laughingly said, "But we can't excuse you. It would be the play of Hamlet with Hamlet left out." Still, Grant insisted. "I appreciate fully the honor," he said, "but time is very precious just now, and really, Mr. President, I believe I have had enough of the show business." Grant's visit to Washington that March solidified his image as a man of the people. The public had already heard stories of his aversion to what Congressman Elihu Washburne called the trappings and paraphernalia so common to many military men. While the bill to establish the new rank of lieutenant general was being debated in Washington, Washburne recounted spending 6 days on the road with Grant, who took with him neither a horse, nor an orderly, nor a servant, nor a camp chest, nor an overcoat, nor a blanket, nor even a clean shirt. Carrying only a toothbrush, he fared like the commonest soldier in his command, partaking of his rations and sleeping upon the ground with no covering except the canopy of heaven. Noting his preference for pork and beans, the New York Times speculated that caterers who had previously served the delicate palates of officers were in spasms. Everything Grant did during his 4-day stay in Washington, from his unheralded entrance to his early departure, was done exactly right, the historian William McFeely concludes. He was consummately modest and quietly confident, the image held for the rest of his political career, and beyond, into history. The spring of 1864 was unusually backward, Bates recorded in his diary. Trees that normally blossomed in early April did not put out their leaves until the end of the month. To those waiting anxiously for the Army's spring campaign to begin, it seemed that the stormy and inclement weather, which brought torrents of rain day after day, was nature's attempt to forestall the inevitable bloodshed. Stoddard speculated that Grant was detained by the same old enemy that had stymied McClellan, obstructed Burnside, and allowed Lee to escape after Gettysburg, The Red Mud of the Old Dominion. Lincoln remained convinced that in Ulysses S. Grant he had finally found the commander he needed. At a White House reception in late March, held in the midst of the toughest snowstorm of the year, Benjamin French reported that the president was as full of fun and story as ever I saw him. 3 weeks later, on another stormy day, Lincoln was still as pleasant and funny as could be, entertaining an immense crowd of visitors at his Saturday levee. The following Sunday, he strolled into John Hay's room, picked up a paper, and read the Richmond Examiner's recent attack on Jeff Davis. It amused him. "Why," said he, "the Examiner seems about as fond of Jeff as the world is of me." That Jefferson Davis was under attack in his own house was not surprising. In the spring of 1864, the Confederacy was a beleaguered nation, in James Randall's words. Finances were shaky, currency was unsound, the foreign outlook was never bright. Though rebel convictions remained remarkably steady, there was real suffering among the people. A letter intended to be sent overseas fell into the hands of a New York Times correspondent. The writer, a Virginian, acknowledged the harsh impact of the blockade and rampant inflation upon daily life. "Refined and graceful ladies, who have been used to drink Chambertin and to eat the rich beef and mutton, are reduced to such a state that they know not tea nor coffee and are glad to put up daily with a slice or two of the coarsest bacon." Furthermore, the mass of misery increased exponentially as one goes down in the social scale. Food riots had broken out in Richmond and Atlanta, and clothing was in such short supply that shops were vandalized. Davis's health gradually succumbed to the strain. His innate despondency deepened. Friends noticed a withdrawn air about him, and his evening rides were often companionless. Only the company of his wife, Verena, and his family let him truly relax and replenish his energies. Much like Lincoln, he spoiled his children, letting them interrupt grave cabinet meetings and enjoying their games. Tragedy struck the Davis household on the last day of April 1864. Verena Davis had left 5-year-old Joseph and his 7-year-old brother, Jeff Jr., for a few moments while she brought lunch to her husband in his second-floor office. Little Joe had climbed onto the balcony railing and lost his balance. He died when his head hit the brick pavement below. His parents were inconsolable. It was said that Verena's screams could be heard for hours, while Davis isolated himself on the top floor. The tramp of his feet pacing up and down recalled the diarist Mary Chestnut, wife of Confederate General James Chestnut, produced an eerie echo in the drawing room below. The relentless pace of the war allowed little time for mourning, for Davis understood, as did Lincoln, that it was only a matter of days before the spring campaign would begin. By the first week of May, William Stoddard observed, Washington was filled with an oppressive sense of something coming, almost like the pause and hush before the coming of the hurricane. Although the trees were finally full of buds and blossoms, and a few adventurous birds had begun to sing, the day had no spring sunshine in it, nor any temptations to make music, for everyone knew that ominous events were imminent. While confidence in Grant remained high, many people, Nicolay conceded, were beginning to feel superstitious about his prospects, since previous spring campaigns had so generally been failures. Aware that communications would be sporadic once Lieutenant General Grant launched his assault on Lee, Lincoln wrote him a letter that Hay described as full of kindness and dignity at once. He conveyed his entire satisfaction with what you have done, and promised that if there is anything wanting, which is within my power to give, it would be provided. Grant graciously replied that he had thus far been astonished at the readiness with which everything asked for has been yielded. The final line of Grant's letter illustrated the profound difference between his character and McClellan's. Should my success be less than I desire and expect, the least I can say is, the fault is not with you. Lincoln had heartily approved Grant's plan to move in three directions at once. The Army of the Potomac would strike Lee head-on, forcing him to retreat south toward Richmond. Sherman would move through Georgia from west to east, with the aim of capturing Atlanta. Butler, meanwhile, would move northeast against Richmond from the James River. This concerted movement, Lincoln reminded Hay, was what he had wanted all along, so as to bring into action, to our advantage, our great superiority in numbers. Still, on the eve of battle, Lincoln felt great solicitude for his lieutenant general, telling Browning that while he had complete confidence in Grant, he feared that Lee would select his own ground and await an attack, which would give him great advantages. Lincoln's fears proved prescient. As Grant moved south, Lee awaited him in an area just west of Fredericksburg, known as the Wilderness, an unforgiving maze of craggy ravines and slippery bogs, dense with vines and thorn bushes. The gloomy terrain provided cover for Lee's earthworks and prevented Grant's superb artillery from being used. It effectively negated the Union's superiority of numbers. Nonetheless, Grant pushed relentlessly south to Spotsylvania and Cold Harbor, slightly northeast of Richmond, engaging Lee in a hideous struggle. Men on both sides had to climb over the dead and dying, lying in some places in piles 3 and 4 deep. Grant's biographer calls the campaign a nightmare of inhumanity, resulting in 86,000 Union and Confederate casualties in the space of 7 weeks. The world has never seen so bloody and so protracted a battle as the one being fought, Grant told his wife at the end of the first 9 days, and I hope never will again. He later admitted in his memoirs that he always regretted that the last assault at Cold Harbor was ever made. Grant buried the dead and sent the wounded to Washington, where they arrived by the thousands. Noah Brooks recorded the heartbreaking scene as steamers reached the city wharves carrying the shattered wrecks of brave soldiers. Long trains of ambulances are in waiting, and the suffering heroes are tenderly handled and brought out upon stretchers, though with some of them even the lightest touch is torture and pain. The ghastly scene, repeated day after day, was hard for Washingtonians to bear. Judge Taft was present at the wharves one morning when 3,000 wounded soldiers disembarked, some with their heads bound up and some with their arms in a sling, others limping along. As each steamer landed, crowds gathered around, hoping to recognize in a maimed and battle-stained form, once so proud and manly, a husband, son, or brother. Elizabeth Blair fled the city, admitting that the lines of ambulances and the moans of their poor suffering men were too much for my nerves. The carnage has been unexampled, a depressed Bates lamented in his diary. Even the optimistic Seward acknowledged in his European circular that it seems to myself like exaggeration when I find that in describing conflict after conflict in this energetic campaign, I am required always to say of the last one that it was the severest battle of the war. The immense tension in the War Department, where the cabinet colleagues gathered each night to await the latest news, made it impossible to carry out ordinary business. The intense anxiety is oppressive, Wells conceded, and almost unfits the mind for mental activity. John Nicolay wrote to Tharina that he was more nervous and anxious during these weeks than he had been for a year previous. Still, he added, if my own anxiety is so great, what must be the president's solicitude after waiting through 3 long, weary years of doubt and disaster? There were indeed nights when Lincoln did not sleep. One of these nights, Francis Carpenter met him, clad in a long morning wrapper, pacing back and forth, his hands behind him, great black rings under his eyes, his head bent forward upon his breast. There were moments when he was overwhelmed with sorrow at the appalling loss of life. As the leader of his cabinet and the leader of his country, however, he understood the need to remain collected and project hope and confidence to his colleagues and his people. Between anxious hours at the War Department awaiting news from the front, Lincoln made time to get to the theater, attend a public lecture on Gettysburg, and see an opera. "People may think strange of it," he explained, "but I must have some relief from this terrible anxiety, or it will kill me." Schuyler Colfax came to visit one Sunday during the Battle of the Wilderness. I saw Lincoln walk up and down the executive chamber, his long arms behind his back, his dark features contracted still more with gloom, and as he looked up I thought his face the saddest one I had ever seen. But, Colfax added, he quickly recovered, and suddenly spoke of Grant with such confidence that hope beamed on his face. An hour later, greeting a delegation of congressional visitors, he managed to tell story after story, which hid his saddened heart from their keen and anxious scrutiny. Lincoln never lost faith in Grant. He realized that whereas any other general would have retreated after sustaining such terrible losses, Grant somehow retained the dogged pertinacity that wins. Lincoln hugged and kissed a young reporter on the forehead who arrived at the White House with a verbal message from the general that said, "There is to be no turning back." His spirits rose further when he read the words in Grant's famous dispatch on May 11th, "I propose to fight it out on this line if it takes all summer." When a visitor asked one day about the prospects of the army under Grant, Lincoln's face lit up. With that peculiar smile which he always puts on when about to tell a good story. The question, he said, reminds me of a little anecdote about the automaton chess player, which many years ago astonished the world by its skill in that game. After a while, the automaton was challenged by a celebrated player, who, to his great chagrin, was beaten twice by the machine. At the end of the second game, the player, significantly pointing his finger at the automaton, exclaimed in a very decided tone, "There's a man in it!" That, he explained, referring to Grant, was the secret to the army's fortunes. In early June, when the Republican convention was set to open in Baltimore, Salmon Chase grew restless. Though he had withdrawn his name from the race the previous March, he still retained the hope that events might turn in his favor. Thurlow Weed had repeatedly warned the president that Chase's withdrawal was simply a shrewd dodge that would allow him to turn up again with more strength than ever. The well-informed political boss had compiled a long list of Treasury employees who were devoting all their energies to the Chase campaign. More troubling still, Weed had heard from myriad sources that corrupt Treasury agents were exchanging army supplies for Confederate cotton in violation of the congressional law that forbade any trade between the free and slave states without an express permit from the Treasury. Weed believed that Chase's son-in-law, Sprague, was a beneficiary of one of these schemes. He could not fathom Lincoln's refusal to fire Chase, predicting that if the president goes into the canvass with this millstone tied to him, he will inevitably sink. Meanwhile, the smoldering feud between Chase and the Blairs erupted into full public view. With the army in winter quarters the previous January, Frank Blair had resigned his commission and retaken his seat in Congress. He intended to return to Sherman's command in time for the march to Atlanta, but first he had a score to settle with Chase. A Chase partisan had publicly accused Blair of swindling the government by charging $8,000 for a personal shipment of liquor and tobacco. Blair knew the document in question was spurious and suspected that it had been forged in the Treasury Department. He asked a congressional committee to investigate the matter. The resulting report fully exonerated Blair. The accusing document was indeed a forgery penned by a Treasury agent. Although there was no suggestion of Chase's personal involvement, Blair waited for the issuance of the committee's report before rising to speak on the floor. Addressing a packed audience the day before his scheduled departure for Sherman's army, he began by calmly summarizing the report's findings. His self-control swiftly vanished, however, as he turned his anger on Chase. "These dogs have been set on me by their master, and since I have whipped them back into their kennel, I mean to hold their master responsible for this outrage, and not the curs who have been set upon me." Speaker Colfax admonished Blair to stick to the committee report, but Blair's supporters insisted that he be allowed to continue. He accused Chase of corruption, treachery against Lincoln, lack of patriotism, and sordid ambition for the presidency. Elizabeth Blair, present in the galleries, believed the speech a complete triumph in the short run, but worried about its livid tone. "Anger is the poorest of counselors," she conceded, "and revenge is suicide." She was right to worry, for the speech inflamed the ongoing war between Chase and Blair that would end by damaging both men. Chase's friends reacted quickly, labeling the accusations against the Treasury Secretary mendacious slanders. Gideon Welles considered the speech violent and injudicious, and feared that it would ultimately hurt the president. The wise Navy Secretary was dismayed by the continuing feud between Chase and the Blairs, believing both sides shared the blame. "Chase is deficient in magnanimity and generosity. The Blairs have both, but they have strong resentments. Warfare with them is open, bold, and unsparing. With Chase, it is silent, persistent, but regulated with discretion." Chase was told about the speech later that night as he boarded a train to the Sanitary Fair in Baltimore. His friend, Congressman Albert Riddle, joined him in his private car. He was alone, Riddle recalled, and in a frightful rage, and controlled himself with difficulty while he explained the cause. The recital in a hoarse, constrained voice seemed to rekindle his anger and aggravate his intensity. The spacious car fairly trembled under his feet. Chase felt certain that all this, including the speech, had been done with the cordial approval of the president. Ohio Congressman James Garfield agreed with this assessment. He considered Frank Blair Lincoln's creature, sent to the House for the special purpose of destroying Chase's reputation. With this accomplished, Garfield charged, Lincoln would simply renew Blair's commission and return him to the front, thus ratifying all he said and did while here. Chase told Riddle that unless Lincoln repudiated Blair, he would feel honor-bound once again to tender his resignation. Riddle and another friend of Chase's, Rufus Spaulding, called on the president. They warned him that Chase's abrupt resignation now would be equal in its effects to a severe setback of the army under Grant. Explaining that the coincidence of Blair's vicious speech and the president's renewal of his commission seemed as if planned for dramatic effect, as parts of a conspiracy against a most important member of the cabinet, they demanded to know if Lincoln had known, ahead of time, the nature of Blair's remarks. Lincoln had prepared well for the encounter. The last thing he wanted was for Chase to resign on a point of honor. The rift between the radicals and conservatives in the Republican Party might then become irreparable. He gave the visitors his usual undivided attention. When they finished, Riddle recalled, he arose, came round, and with great cordiality took each of us by the hand and evinced the greatest satisfaction at our presence. Then, taking up a stack of papers on his desk, he inquired if either of them had seen his letter to Chase 2 months earlier, when the secretary had offered to resign over his implication in the humiliating Pomeroy circular. Determining that Riddle had not, Lincoln read aloud the lines where he concurred with Chase that neither of them should be held responsible for what our respective friends may do without our instigation or countenance. He explained that while he had great respect for Frank Blair, he was annoyed and mortified by the speech. He had, in fact, warned Blair against pursuing a personal warfare. As soon as he heard of Blair's rant, Lincoln knew that another beehive was kicked over, and considered canceling the orders restoring him to the army and assigning him to command. After assessing how much General Sherman valued Frank's services, however, he had decided to let the orders stand. In making his case, Riddle recalled, Lincoln was plain, sincere, and most impressive. Riddle and Spaulding were perfectly satisfied and assured Lincoln that Chase would be, too. Once again, Lincoln had sutured a potentially dangerous wound within his administration and his party. It was a warm day on June 7, 1864, when Republicans gathered in Baltimore to choose their candidates for president and vice president. Noah Brooks was moved by the sight of the people's representatives gathering in the midst of a civil war and in the actual din of battle to perform the most precious function of democracy. The Democrats would also meet that summer, though they delayed their convention until the end of August, to give themselves a better chance to react to the latest events on the battlefield. As the delegates from 25 states flocked to the Republican convention, which was relabeled the National Union Convention, Lincoln's renomination was assured. So certain was the outcome that David Davis, who had been instrumental in guiding Lincoln to the nomination 4 years earlier, chose not to attend. He had originally planned to go, he told Lincoln, but since the New York and Ohio conventions, the necessity for doing so is foreclosed. I have kept count of all the states that have instructed, and you must be nominated by acclamation. If there had been a speck of opposition, I would have gone to Baltimore. But the opposition is so utterly beaten that the fight is not even interesting, and the services of no one is necessary. In Judge Davis's stead, Lincoln sent John Nicolay as his personal emissary to the convention. Even Horace Greeley, while holding out for an alternative, acknowledged that the president had earned an honored place in the hearts of his fellow Americans. The people think of him by night and by day, and pray for him, and their hearts are where they have made so heavy investments. Long before the convention opened its doors, the official nominating committee said popular instinct had plainly indicated Lincoln as its candidate, and the work of the convention was simply to register the popular will. While politicians in Washington may have entertained other prospects, Brooks observed, the country at large really thought of no name but Lincoln's. There were, of course, some pockets of resistance. At the end of May, several hundred malcontents had gathered in Cleveland's Chapin Hall to nominate John Fremont for president on a third-party ticket. Fremont had never forgiven Lincoln for relieving him of command in 1861. Though he had eventually been offered another commission, he had refused upon learning that he would report to another general. His supporters were a mix of radicals, abolitionists, disappointed office-seekers, and copperheads. They hope to split the Republican Party with a platform calling for a constitutional amendment ending slavery. They demanded that Congress, rather than the president, take the lead on Reconstruction, and pressed for the confiscation of the lands of the rebels and their distribution among the soldiers. Lincoln had been in the telegraph office when reports of the Fremont Convention came over the wires. Hearing that the attendance was a mere 400 of the expected thousands, he was reminded of a passage in the Bible. Opening his Bible to 1 Samuel chapter 22, verse 2, he read aloud, "And every one that was in distress, and every one that was in debt, and every one that was discontented, gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men." The night before the Baltimore Convention, Lincoln talked with Noah Brooks. When Brooks observed that his renomination was an absolute certainty, Lincoln cheerfully conceded that point without any false modesty. Understanding that there were several candidates for vice president, including the incumbent Hannibal Hamlin, New York's Daniel Dickinson, and Tennessee's military governor Andrew Johnson, Lincoln declined to express his preference. He did say, however, that he hoped that the convention would declare in favor of the constitutional amendment abolishing slavery, and he asked Brooks to report back to him all the odd bits of gossip that a good reporter would pick up. As expected, the convention was initially confronted with two contesting delegations from Missouri, an anti-Blair radical delegation, pledged to vote for Grant as a means of expressing displeasure with Lincoln, and a pro-Blair conservative delegation, pledged to Lincoln. With the president's approval, the radical delegation was seated. Lincoln understood the importance, as one delegate put it, of integrating all the elements of the Republican Party, including the impracticables, the Pharisees, the better-than-thou declaimers, the long-haired men, and the short-haired women. Moreover, the radicals had tacitly agreed that they would switch their votes to Lincoln after the first ballot, making the president's nomination unanimous. Nothing better indicated the nation's transformation since the Chicago Convention 4 years earlier than the tumultuous applause that greeted the third resolution of the platform. "Resolved, that as slavery was the cause, and now constitutes the strength, of this rebellion, we demand its utter and complete extirpation from the soil of the Republic." While upholding the president's proclamation, which aimed a death blow at this gigantic evil, the resolution continued, "We are in favor, furthermore, of a constitutional amendment to forever prohibit the existence of slavery in the United States." Resounding applause also greeted the resolution thanking soldiers and sailors who have periled their lives in defense of their country. But the crowd's greatest demonstration was reserved for the resolution endorsing Lincoln's leadership. "The enthusiasm was terrific," Brooks noted, "the convention breaking out into yells and cheers unbounded as soon as the beloved name of Lincoln was spoken." The only discordant note was the passage of a radical plank aimed at conservative Montgomery Blair, calling for a purge of any cabinet member who failed to support the platform in full. Harmony was restored when the roll call nominating Lincoln was completed, at which point, the National Republican noted, the audience rose en masse, and such an enthusiastic demonstration was scarcely ever paralleled. Men waved their hands and hats, and ladies in the galleries their kerchiefs, while the band played the Star-Spangled Banner. The next order of business was the nomination of a vice president. Though Thurlow Weed was not a delegate, his towering presence played a central role in the selection of Andrew Johnson. Always alive to the interests of his oldest friend, Seward, Weed at once understood that if New York's Daniel Dickinson received the vice presidential nod, Seward might not retain his position as Secretary of State. An unwritten rule dictated that two significant posts could not be allotted to a single state. Weed had initially supported Hamlin, but soon saw that the growing sentiment for a war Democrat would result in the nomination of either Dickinson or Johnson. He placed the Weed-Seward machine behind the victorious Johnson. The results of the convention were routed through the telegraph office at the War Department. It was Stanton's theory, his secretary explained, that everything concerned his own department, and he had centralized into his office the whole telegraphic system of the United States. Lincoln was present in the late afternoon when a clerk handed him a dispatch reporting Johnson's nomination. Having not yet heard his own nomination confirmed, Lincoln was startled. "What? Do they nominate a vice president before they do a president? Is that not putting the cart before the horse?" The embarrassed operator explained that the dispatch about the president's nomination had come in several hours earlier, while Lincoln was at lunch, and had been sent directly to the White House. "It is all right," replied Lincoln. "I shall probably find it on my return." The following day, a committee appointed by the delegates arrived at the White House to officially notify Lincoln of his nomination. In response to their laudatory statement, Lincoln said he did not assume that the convention had found him to be the best man in the country. "But I am reminded in this connection of a story of an old Dutch farmer who remarked to a companion once that it was not best to swap horses when crossing streams." Later that night, when the Ohio delegation came to serenade him at the White House, he humbly directed their attention to the soldiers in the field. "What we want, still more than Baltimore conventions or presidential elections, is success under General Grant," he said. "I propose that you help me to close up what I am now saying with three rousing cheers for General Grant and the officers and soldiers under his command." A visitor to the White House at this time told Lincoln that nothing could defeat him but Grant's capture of Richmond, to be followed by the general's nomination at Chicago, where the Democratic convention was scheduled to take place later that summer. "Well," said Lincoln, "I feel very much like the man who said he didn't want to die particularly, but if he had got to die, that was precisely the disease he would like to die of." Chapter 24. Atlanta is ours. Union hopes for imminent victory faded as the spring of 1864 gave way to summer. "Our troops have suffered much and accomplished but little," Gideon Wells recorded in his diary on June 20th. "The immense slaughter of our brave men chills and sickens us all." Unable to dislodge Lee's troops, who displayed what the White House Secretary William Stoddard called an awe-inspiring, steady courage, Grant settled in for a siege at Petersburg. Meanwhile, Sherman was encountering tough resistance as he moved slowly through Georgia. Daily reports of the brutal battles in Virginia and Georgia provoked a particular dread in the Sewards, the Blairs, the Bates, and the Wellses, all of whom had loved ones at the front. For the Sewards, whose youngest son William nearly lost his life at Cold Harbor, there were many sleepless nights. "I cannot yet bring myself to the contemplation of your death or of your suffering, as others have done," Frances Seward told Will, though she considered that he was fighting for a holy cause in a righteous conflict, unlike the Mexican War, which she had vigorously opposed when her older son Augustus had been in the army. Elizabeth Blair had become so nervous with her husband in the Navy and her brother Frank moving toward Atlanta with Sherman that she quaked all night with terror. Even her normally cheerful father was perpetually grave and anxious, certain that if Frank were taken prisoner, the Confederates would be as eager to kill him physically as the Radicals are politically. Bates feared for his 21-year-old son Coulter, who was with General Meade and the Army of the Potomac, and Wells was pained beyond what I can describe when his 18-year-old son Thomas departed with boyish pride and enthusiasm to join General Grant. "It was uncertain whether we should ever meet again," he recorded in his diary, "and if we do, he may be mutilated and a ruined man." His anxiety left Wells sad and unfit for any labor. The painful apprehension within the administration mirrored the fears experienced in hundreds of thousands of homes throughout the country. Lincoln knew the ravages of this most bloody war had touched every town and household of America. The time had come to revive the oppressed spirits of the people. In mid-June, he found the perfect forum for a public speech when he journeyed to the great Central Fair in Philadelphia, designed to benefit the Sanitary Commission. Thousands of citizens had come from the surrounding area to enjoy the collections of art, statuary, and flowers, the zoological garden, restaurants, raffles, and games that covered a 2-mile concourse and were said to offer miracles as many as Faust saw in his journey through the world of magic. At 7 o'clock on the morning of June 16th, Lincoln, Mary, and Tad left for Philadelphia by train. Word of their journey had spread. At every depot along the way, cheering crowds gathered for a glimpse of the first family. Arriving before noon, they were escorted in an open carriage up Broad Street to Chestnut Street and the Continental Hotel. The streets were lined with citizens, and the windows crowded with ladies waving their handkerchiefs. The unbounded ardor and spontaneous applause was such, one reporter noted, as had not been heard for many a day in Philadelphia. Lincoln declined to speak at the hotel or at the fairgrounds that afternoon, preferring to wait until the dinner that evening. Perhaps he knew that his remarks, which he had carefully drafted, would be recorded more accurately in that setting. War, at the best, is terrible. And this war of ours, in its magnitude and in its duration, is one of the most terrible, he began. It has destroyed property and ruined homes. It has produced a national debt and taxation unprecedented. It has carried mourning to almost every home, until it can almost be said that the heavens are hung in black. Nonetheless, he reminded his listeners, we accept this war for an object, a worthy object, and the war will end when that object is attained. Under God, I hope it never will until that time. The force of his words, and the unshakable determination they embodied, instantly uplifted and emboldened his audience. A few days later, in order to stem his own intense anxiety about the stalemate in Virginia, Lincoln decided to visit Grant at his headquarters at City Point. Wells strongly disapproved of the decision. He can do no good, he predicted. It can hardly be otherwise than to do harm, even if no accident befalls him. Better for him and the country that he should remain at his post here. The Navy Secretary failed to understand the importance of these trips to Lincoln, who needed the contact with the troops to lift his own spirits, so that he in turn could better buoy the spirits of those around him. Accompanied by Tad and Assistant Navy Secretary Gustavus Fox, Lincoln left the Washington Navy Yard aboard the river steamer Baltimore in the early evening of June 20th. The journey to City Point, which was about 180 miles farther south by water than Aquia Creek, took more than 16 hours. Horace Porter, Grant's aide-de-camp, recalled that when the steamer arrived at the wharf, Lincoln came down from the upper deck and reaching out his long, angular arm, he wrung General Grant's hand vigorously and held it in his for some time. As he expressed great appreciation for all that Grant had been through since they last met in Washington. Introduced to the members of Grant's staff, the President had for each one a cordial greeting and a pleasant word. There was a kindliness in his tone and a hearty manner of expression which went far to captivate all who met him. Over a plain and substantial lunch, typical of the hero of Vicksburg, noted the Herald correspondent, Lincoln conversed entertainingly and delivered three capital jokes that provoked hilarity. When the meal was finished, Grant suggested a ride to the front 10 miles away. Porter noted that Lincoln made an odd appearance on his horse as his trousers gradually worked up above his ankles and gave him the appearance of a country farmer riding into town wearing his Sunday clothes. The sight bordered upon the grotesque, but the troops he passed along the way were so lost in admiration of the man that the humorous aspect did not seem to strike them. Cheers broke forth from all the commands, and enthusiastic shouts and even words of familiar greeting met him on all sides. Reaching the front, the President took a long and lingering look at the sights of Petersburg, where Lee's armies were gathered behind formidable earthworks. On the return trip, they passed a brigade of black soldiers who rushed forward to greet the President, screaming, yelling, shouting, "Hurrah for the Liberator! Hurrah for the President!" Their spontaneous outburst moved Lincoln to tears, and his voice was so broken by emotion that he could hardly reply. That evening, Porter recalled, as Lincoln sat for hours with General Grant and his staff, "we had an opportunity of appreciating his charm as a talker and hearing some of the stories for which he had become celebrated." The young aide-de-camp observed what so many others had seen before, that Lincoln did not tell a story merely for the sake of the anecdote, but to point a moral or clench a fact. Seated on a low camp chair, with his long legs wrapped around each other, as if in an effort to get them out of the way, he used his arms to accompany his words and joined heartily with the listeners in the laugh which followed. Discussion of a new form of gunpowder prompted a story of two competing powder merchants in Springfield. The sight of a newly patented artillery trace led to the recitation of a line from a poem, "Sorrow had fled, but left her traces there." Reference to the Electoral College brought forth the quaint observation that "the Electoral College is the only one where they choose their own masters." When the convivial evening came to a close, the President walked with Porter to his tent, taking a peek inside, from curiosity, doubtless, to see how the officers were quartered, before returning to his stateroom on the Baltimore. The next morning, in excellent spirits, Lincoln steamed up the James River with Grant to visit General Butler and Admiral Samuel Phillips Lee, Elizabeth Blair's husband. Talking with Butler about Grant, he observed that when Grant once gets possession of a place, he holds on to it as if he had inherited it. After lunch, it was time to return to Washington. On taking leave, General Grant took Lincoln aside, assuring him, with a rousing pledge that the President would repeat and cite in the weeks ahead, "You will never hear of me farther from Richmond than now, till I have taken it. I am just as sure of going into Richmond as I am of any future event. It may take a long summer day, but I will go in." On the morning of June 23rd, John Hay reported that Lincoln returned to the White House, sunburnt and fagged, but still refreshed and cheered. He found the army in fine health, good position, and good spirits. The next day, at the regular Friday cabinet meeting, the skeptical Wells conceded that the trip to the front had done him good, physically, and strengthened him mentally in confidence in the general and army. and of signal importance, Lincoln could now better project his own renewed hope to the anxious public. Lauding Grant's extraordinary qualities as a commander, to one reporter, and speaking to another, of the condition of army matters in the very highest terms of confidence. Acutely aware of his own emotional needs, Lincoln had chosen exactly the right time to review the troops, for his conversations with Grant and his interactions with the soldiers sustained and inspired him during the troubling days ahead. "Having hope," writes Daniel Goleman in his study of emotional intelligence, "means that one will not give in to overwhelming anxiety, a defeatist attitude, or depression in the face of difficult challenges or setbacks. Hope is more than the sunny view that everything will turn out all right. It is believing you have the will and the way to accomplish your goals." More clearly than his colleagues, Lincoln understood that numerous setbacks were inevitable before the war could be brought to a close. Yet in the end, he firmly believed the North would prevail. "We are, today, further ahead than I thought 1 year and a half ago we should be," he told Noah Brooks that June. "And yet there are plenty of people who believe that the war is about to be substantially closed. As God is my judge, I shall be satisfied if we are over with the fight in Virginia within a year." By the last week of June, the forbearance Lincoln had long shown toward his ambitious Secretary of the Treasury was finally exhausted. The dramatic upheaval in the cabinet began when John Sisko, Assistant Treasurer of New York, announced his resignation. Sisko had held the prestigious post through three different administrations and was well respected by all factions. Lincoln was anxious that his replacement satisfy both wings of New York's Republican Party. For several months, the president had been bombarded by complaints from friends in New York, including Thurlow Weed and Senator Edwin Morgan, that Chase was filling all the Customs House positions with his own partisans, former Democrats who were now radical Republicans supporting Chase's own presidential hopes. Sensitive to Weed's concerns, Lincoln told Chase to consult with Senator Morgan and ensure that his selection was satisfactory to all sides. Chase discussed the matter with the powerful New York senator, but then proceeded, over Morgan's strong objection, to send Lincoln a formal nomination for Mansell Field. A Democratic journalist with ties to New York society, Field was serving as third Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, a post Chase had designed especially to compensate Field for the access he had provided Chase to the inner circles of New York literary and social life. "The appointment was stunning," recalled the Treasury Registrar, Lucius Chittenden, "for Field had no financial or political standing, and his natural abilities were of a literary rather than an executive character." Undeterred, Chase apparently assumed that his own services were so indispensable that Lincoln would sanction a controversial nominee rather than risk a messy squabble when the financial health of the nation was at stake. Chase awoke the morning after sending the Field nomination to the White House and cheerfully undertook his daily reading of the Bible, which, on that summer morning, included a letter St. Paul sent to the Ephesians imploring them to "Stand, therefore, having your loins girt about with truth, and having on the breastplate of righteousness." When he reached the department, however, he found a disturbing note from the president on his desk. "I cannot, without much embarrassment, make this appointment," Lincoln informed him, "principally because of Senator Morgan's very firm opposition to it." "It would really oblige him," he said, "if Chase and Senator Morgan could agree on another nominee." Still confident that he could change the president's mind, Chase wrote an immediate request for a personal interview. When Lincoln did not respond, Chase decided to resolve the difficulty on his own. He telegraphed Sisko in New York and pleaded with him to withdraw his resignation and stay on for another 3 months. Before obtaining Sisko's answer, he received Lincoln's reply to his interview request. "The difficulty," wrote Lincoln, "does not, in the main part, lie within the range of a conversation between you and me." Lincoln went on to explain the criticism he had faced in the previous months over Treasury appointments in New York, and noted that to disregard Morgan's judgment in this instance might trigger open revolt. Sisko's agreement to stay on should have ended the matter, but Chase, peeved at Lincoln's refusal to meet in person, and bent on reestablishing his authority over his own appointments, could not rest. He decided to chasten the president with what was essentially his fourth letter of resignation, certain it would again be rejected. He began his letter by enclosing Sisko's telegram withdrawing his resignation, which he acknowledged relieves the present difficulty. But then he went on, "I cannot help feeling that my position here is not altogether agreeable to you, and it is certainly too full of embarrassment and difficulty and painful responsibility to allow in me the least desire to retain it. I think it my duty, therefore, to enclose to you my resignation." Lincoln was seated at his desk in his office, he later recalled, when a messenger handed him a letter from the Treasury Department. "I opened it, recognized Chase's handwriting, read the first sentence, and inferred from its tenor that this matter was in the way of satisfactory adjustment. I was truly glad of this, and laying the envelope with its enclosure down upon the desk, went on talking. People were coming and going all the time till 3 o'clock, and I forgot all about Chase's letter. At that hour, it occurred to me that I would go downstairs and get a bit of lunch. My wife happened to be away, and they had failed to call me at the usual time." Mary was in Massachusetts for Robert's graduation from Harvard. "While I was sitting alone at table, my thoughts reverted to Chase's letter, and I determined to answer it just as soon as I should go upstairs again. Well, as soon as I was back here, I took pen and paper and prepared to write. But then it occurred to me that I might as well read the letter before I answered it. I took it out of the envelope for that purpose, and as I did so, another enclosure fell from it upon the floor. I picked it up, read it, and said to myself, 'Hallo, this is a horse of another color.' It was his resignation. I put my pen into my mouth and grit my teeth upon it. I did not long reflect." Lincoln quickly perceived that Chase was essentially saying, "You have been acting very badly. Unless you say you are sorry and ask me to stay and agree that I shall be absolute and that you shall have nothing, no matter how you beg for it, I will go." This presumption the president could not and would not countenance. He took his pen from his mouth and began to write. "Your resignation of the office of Secretary of the Treasury," he tersely opened, "is accepted. Of all I have said in commendation of your ability and fidelity, I have nothing to unsay. And yet, you and I have reached a point of mutual embarrassment in our official relation, which, it seems, cannot be overcome or longer sustained consistently with the public service." Early the next morning, Lincoln called John Hay into his office and asked him to deliver the news of Chase's resignation to the Senate as soon as it convened, along with his recommendation of former Ohio Governor David Todd as his successor. "It is a big fish," he said. "I thought I could not stand it any longer." Though worried that the president was making a costly mistake, the loyal Hay proceeded to the Capitol, reaching the Senate just as the chaplain recited the opening prayer. Still ignorant of the president's letter, Chase went about his daily business, anticipating Lincoln's penitent request for him to continue his duties. Perhaps Lincoln would personally visit his office, put his arm around him, and again tell him how much he was needed. After breakfast, Chase went to his office, where he received word that Senator Fessenden of Maine wanted to see him immediately at the Capitol. Riding in his carriage, he surmised that the chairman of the Finance Committee wanted to discuss the various financial bills currently before him. In the midst of his conversation with Fessenden, a messenger arrived to tell the senator of David Todd's nomination. "Have you resigned?" the distraught Fessenden asked. "I am called to the Senate and told that the President has sent in the nomination of your successor." Stunned, Chase explained that he had indeed sent in his resignation, but did not know that it had been accepted. Returning at once to the department, Chase found the letter from Lincoln. Reaching the part where Lincoln spoke of mutual embarrassment in their relations, Chase was dumbfounded. "I had found a good deal of embarrassment from him," he recorded in his diary that night, "but what he had found from me I could not imagine, unless it has been created by my unwillingness to have offices distributed by spoils or benefits with more regard to the claims of divisions, factions, cliques, and individuals than to fitness of selection." Blinded by self-righteousness, and donning what Nicolay and Hay termed his full armor of noble sentiments, Chase refused to see that in choosing the inexperienced Field, he, not the President, was filling an office on the basis of faction rather than fitness. The startling news spread quickly on Capitol Hill. "The senators were struck dumb with amazement," Noah Brooks reported. The members of the Senate Finance Committee convened an emergency meeting and decided to go as a body to the White House to lodge a vehement protest. "Fessenden was frightened," Lincoln later told Hay. "Conness of California was mad." Lincoln listened patiently to their concerns about losing Chase at this perilous time and their doubts about Todd as a viable successor. Then, reaching into his desk, he pulled out Chase's previous letters of resignation and read them aloud to his visitors, along with the gracious replies that had kept Chase in the cabinet each time. Moreover, though he agreed that Mr. Chase had a full right to indulge in his ambition to be president, he suggested that the indiscretions of Chase's friends had so complicated matters that the two of them disliked to meet each other in person. In fact, in recent weeks, Chase had declined to attend most of the regular cabinet meetings. The situation had become unendurable, Lincoln concluded, this most recent controversy being simply the last straw. Though the committee left dissatisfied, they at least departed with a true picture of the long history behind the final break. Chase's friend, Massachusetts Congressman Samuel Hooper, came in to see the president later that afternoon. He said he felt very nervous and cut up by Chase's departure. Treasury Registrar Lucius Chittenden was equally distraught, telling Lincoln that the loss of Chase was worse than another Bull Run defeat, for there was not a single man in the country who could replace him. "I will tell you," Lincoln said, "how it is with Chase. It is the easiest thing in the world for a man to fall into a bad habit. Chase has fallen into two bad habits. He thinks he has become indispensable to the country. He also thinks he ought to be president. He has no doubt whatever about that." These two unfortunate tendencies, Lincoln explained, had made Chase irritable, uncomfortable, so that he is never perfectly happy unless he is thoroughly miserable. At this point, according to Chittenden, Lincoln paused. "And yet, there is not a man in the Union who would make as good a Chief Justice as Chase," he continued. "And if I have the opportunity, I will make him Chief Justice of the United States." Chittenden concluded that this extraordinary want of vindictiveness towards someone who had caused him such grief proved that Lincoln must move upon a higher plane and be influenced by loftier motives than any man he had ever known. Yet while Lincoln did indeed possess unusual magnanimity, he was also a shrewd politician. He mentioned the chief justiceship to Chittenden, knowing that when Chase learned of it, the prospect might dampen his public opposition. Lincoln made a similar remark to Congressman Hooper. In a relaxed conversation, he expressed his esteem for the secretary and his sincere regret that the two of them had become so awkward and constrained when they got together. When Hooper relayed these comments to his friend, Chase was moved, suggesting that had any such expressions of goodwill been tendered before his resignation, he might have acted differently. Unfortunately, it was too late. The news of Chase's resignation was met with dismay and regret in the country. He was the great magician of the Treasury, the Chicago Tribune wrote. His name will be handed down to history as the greatest financier of his century. Greeley's Tribune went even further, claiming that Mr. Chase is one of the very few great men left in public life since the almost simultaneous decease of Messrs. Clay, Webster, and Calhoun. Choosing a worthy successor was vital, and it was not clear that David Todd was up to the task. Any concerns Lincoln might have had about his hasty choice were alleviated, however, when he received a telegram from the former governor declining the post for reasons of health. According to Francis Carpenter, Lincoln laid awake some hours, canvassing in his mind the merits of various public men. By morning, he had found the ideal solution, a candidate so perfect he should have considered him from the start, William Pitt Fessenden. First, he told Hay the next morning, he knows the ropes thoroughly. As chairman of the Senate Committee on Finance, he knows as much of this special subject as Mr. Chase. Second, he is a man possessing a national reputation and the confidence of the country. Third, he is a radical, without the petulant and vicious fretfulness of many radicals. In a far better humor, Lincoln handed Hay his official nomination of Fessenden to carry to the Senate. When Hay told him that Fessenden was in the reception room waiting to see him, Lincoln said, "Send him in and go at once to the Senate." Understanding that Fessenden might be reluctant, and perhaps remembering that 3 years earlier he had sent in Chase's nomination before securing his acceptance, the president hoped that a fait accompli would once again move the process forward. Lincoln greeted Fessenden warmly and listened politely for a few minutes as the senator suggested a few names for the vacant Treasury post. Smiling, Lincoln finally interrupted and told Fessenden there was no need to continue. He had found his man, and the nomination of Fessenden was already en route to the Senate. "You must withdraw it. I cannot accept," Fessenden cried out, jumping to his feet. He explained that his health was not good, and he was certain that the pressures of the new job would kill him. "If you decline," Lincoln said, "you must do it in open day, for I shall not recall the nomination." Fessenden left with a promise that he would think on it further, though his acceptance was doubtful. Returning to the Senate, Fessenden discovered that his colleagues had unanimously approved his nomination. Encircled by the warmth of their good wishes and congratulations, he began to waver. Telegrams came pouring in from all quarters, he later recalled, insisting that he accept for the good of the nation, that he was an inspired choice for the critical post. It was both the most rewarding and the most miserable day of his life, for he still feared that the duties of the post would be his death. "Very well," the always blunt Stanton told him. "You cannot die better than in trying to save your country." As he was driven to the White House the next morning, however, Fessenden carried with him a letter declining the nomination. It took all of the president's persuasive powers to change his mind. He said the crisis was such as demanded any sacrifice, even life itself, Fessenden recalled, that Providence had never deserted him or the country, and that his choice of me was a special proof that Providence would not desert him. All this and more. In the end, Fessenden felt he could not decline, but at the risk of danger to the country. Fessenden's appointment received universal praise. He is a man of undoubted financial ability and of unsurpassed personal integrity, the Chicago Tribune wrote, reflecting the sentiment of many northern papers. Radicals felt he was one of their own, while conservatives applauded his intelligence and experience. "He is honest," Elizabeth Blair told her husband, "and as Mrs. Jeff Davis once said, the ablest of all the Republican senators." The business world, long familiar with his work on the Senate Finance Committee, breathed a sigh of relief. "I am the most popular man in my country," Fessenden Riley noted several days after his acceptance. "So my official life closes," Chase recorded in his diary on the last day of June. Sadness pervades the entry, written when the oppressive heat of Washington was such, observed Bates, that even the trees in the streets are wilting. Chase believed he had laid broad foundations to secure financial support for the troops, but he knew the job was still unfinished. From this point on, he would not have any real influence. If Chase had hoped his resignation would produce consternation and regret among his cabinet colleagues, he was disappointed. On the night his departure was announced, Blair and Bates called on Wells to talk over the startling event. While they were all surprised, none was sorry to see him go. "I look upon it as a blessing," Wells said. On numerous occasions, Wells had confided doubts about Chase's character to his diary, observing that he lacked the courage and candor to admit his errors, and that his jokes are always clumsy, he is destitute of wit. Bates greeted Chase's retirement with a vague feeling of relief from a burden and a hope of better things, observing that Chase's relations with his fellow cabinet ministers had long since failed to be cordial. And Monty Blair, whose family regarded Chase as a mortal enemy, was thrilled. Old man Blair happily informed Frank that Chase had dropped off at last like a rotten pear, unexpectedly to himself and everybody else. Seward, unlike his other colleagues, expressed no personal pleasure in Chase's demise. He simply informed Francis of his relief that the cabinet crisis did not engender a severe shock in the country. He traced the origin of the present upheaval back to the first day of the administration, when, against his advice, Lincoln had created his compound cabinet. As Chase prepared to leave Washington, he noted sadly that Stanton, warm and cordial as ever, was the only former colleague who came to see him. "No other head of department has called on me since my resignation." If Chase believed the powerful war secretary might feel the slightest compulsion to resign his own place in solidarity with his old friend, however, he was mistaken. In his misery, Chase searched for reasons why Lincoln had so abruptly accepted his resignation. His answers betray an unwillingness to take the slightest responsibility for his own mistake.